My sweat is cementing us together. I find the idea of adhesive, the idea of her being tethered to me, comforting. Trent shuffles into the other room. I can hear the squeak of a bedroom door closing behind him.
Okay.
I want to know if I'm crazy. I don't mean crazy as in silly or even offbeat. I want to know if you think I'm certifiably insane.
Long pause.
I don't think that. Do you think that?
This time it's me who pauses.
Sometimes.
Well, I don't think that you are.
There really is an octopus, you know.
Pause.
I know.
He's taking her. Trent sighs or yawns.
I know that too.
We sit quietly for a moment. Trent is the only person I can be on the phone with and not feel pressured to speak. But I suddenly feel terrible for dragging him out of bed, his own bed with his boyfriend and his healthy dog, to talk to me, in my bed with an octopus and my sick dog, feeling so very alone. It brings back this memory of when Lily and I had been together for maybe only a year and a half. It was November. The Leonid meteor shower was going to be spectacular that year. It wouldn't be that spectacular again until sometime like 2098 or 2131, a year when Lily and I were certain to be stardust ourselves. So I woke us up in the middle of the night, grabbed our pillows and a blanket, and spread them out on the back lawn. I snuggled her in close to me, and we lay there looking up at the fire raining across the sky. Though she never really understood why we would leave the warmth of our comfortable bed for this weak recreation on the cold, hard ground. I don't think she got the magic of meteors. Trent speaks again, since I can't.
I don't know what I would do if I ever lost Wheezy.
The thought to me is unfathomable.
But you will lose Wheezy, I almost say.
I no longer live in a world of ifs. I think of Cal and the tipping point, the point where death is inevitable. Was he right? Is that tipping point actually birth, the beginning of life itself? We will lose everything that matters, or everything that matters will lose us. It is predestined, the nature of life. But I don't tell this to Trent. I don't see the point of dragging my friend out of bed to depress him. I used to think that way about Lily. And now? Loss is no longer just an idea.
Did you see that guy about the thing?
Cal. His name was Cal.
You like him?
I did.
Was he handsome?
Very.
And?
You'll see. I'll show you. Lily burrows her head deeper into my armpit, but in that way she does when she's using me to scratch her nose. In doing this, she raises the octopus toward me, only just the slightest little bit. But I flinch. I hate that I still flinch in his presence.
I can't imagine losing Wheezy.
Don't think about that now. I'll be there for him when he does.
You called wanting to know if I think you're crazy?
Yeah. That and to escape debilitating loneliness.
I think you need to do something big. I think you need to grab life and shake things up. Turn the whole world on its head. Stop playing the octopus's game.
It's the Ferris Bueller in him talking. Over the years, Ferris has become somewhat muted. I like when he bubbles to the surface.
You want to know what I think?
I think maybe you're not crazy enough. When we hang up, I stare at the phone for a while in that strange way you do when you stop taking technology for granted and suddenly you can't imagine how there was just a voice in there talking to you, even if that voice couldn't fully understand you and what's happening in your world. I feel perhaps even more alone than before I called. Although I'm not alone. Not anymore. I can see the anger gestating inside me, growing exponentially, as surely as if I were holding a sonogram printout. It's about to erupt in unimaginable ways. I lift Lily gently from her sleep and grab a blanket from the linen cabinet, and we head outside. I lay the blanket out for us on the grass as best I can with one hand. There is no meteor shower to see tonight, so I turn on the strings of antique light bulbs that hang decoratively over the yard, the ones I usually only turn on for barbecues and parties. The ones that make my backyard look like a festive catalog page where plastic people live carefree lives. We lie on the blanket and look up at them.
What are we doing?
Lily yawns and nuzzles into me again. The night air is warm and still. We're creating a memory.
Why?
I don't tell her why. The answer is, I need it. I need this memory to hold on to if my plan fails and she is no longer here. Because sometimes it's nice to have memories. Don't you have any favorite memories? Lily thinks about this.
All of my memories are my favorite memories.
I'm amazed by this.
Even the bad ones.
Dogs don't remember bad memories.
Envious, I scratch her on the velvet part of her chest. What an incredible way to live. We did this once when you were a puppy. We got out of bed and brought our blanket outside and we lay on the grass looking at stars.
Are those stars?
Lily looks up at the shimmering light bulbs, and even though she can't see, I wonder if she can make out just enough light to imagine them.
Yes.
I lie.
Those are stars.
Their light has traveled for billions of years. Aren't they magnificent? Lily agrees, because she is small, and she's a dog, and to her, even little things, even things she can't see, seem magnificent. We can go back inside in a bit. Lily thinks about this.
No, this is nice.
I'm glad you like the stars. We're going to be spending a lot more time underneath them. I pause before telling her my plan, or at least that the time for my plan has come. Trent has confirmed it for me. We're leaving here soon, and I don't know if we're coming back.
We're leaving here soon? Where are we going?
I squeeze her tight in the way I do when I'm asking her to trust me, to follow me as we leave the only home she probably ever remembers. Maybe you're not crazy enough. We're going on an awfully big adventure. Death. Death is the awfully big adventure. But not this time. Not this adventure. The greatest adventure, our adventure, is the fight to live. I place my hand over the clear plastic bandage that covers my tattoo. I was only supposed to wear it for a few hours, but I figured a few hours more wouldn't hurt. I peek underneath and see the tips of 8 arms dangling to breathe. I am done waiting. I am done being walked all over by a spineless intruder. I'm tired of fighting the fight on his terms. Trent was right. I haven't been crazy enough. Haven't been. That all stops now. I can feel the change surging inside me. In my nerves, in my organs, in my veins. My transformation is almost complete. 8. I'm able to navigate the streets of Chinatown with relative ease, relying on memory, even though I haven't been here since they closed the Empress Pavilion, a place I used to frequent for dim sum and celebrity sightings. I cruise the streets, trying to distinguish the fish markets from the groceries. I creep along slowly in the outside lane, but no one honks. There are a number of mom-and-pop stores along both Broadway and North Spring. But since the awnings are in Chinese, except for one, which may be a bodega, it's hard to tell which is what. So I nab a metered spot on Spring to continue my investigative errand on foot. The Chinatown in Los Angeles is not nearly as chaotic, nor as Chinese, as the Chinatowns in New York and San Francisco. On a weekday afternoon, it's easy to stroll in and out of stores, taking in their exotic contents. The fish market I come to first has nothing more exotic than Maine lobster and Dungeness crab. I think of asking if they have hidden inventory in the back, but I'm afraid they might sell some sort of illegal catch, like endangered sea urchin or poisonous puffer fish, and I don't want anything like that. I'm not that crazy. The second place I try on Broadway is more to my liking. It feels less touristy, more authentically Chinese. I don't immediately see what I'm looking for laid out on crushed ice, but I have no problem asking the fishmonger. He has a kind and wizened face. I'm looking for octopus. A kind and wizened face that looks back at me confused. I try to explain so that he doesn't inadvertently sell me some sort of Chinese goblin, a mogwai, like in the movie Gremlins. Something that will ultimately do more harm than good. But I don't know the Chinese word for octopus, so I hold up 8 fingers, then invert my hands and wiggle them.
Ah, Chang Yi.
He walks me to the end of the case and I see them lying motionless on the ice, a half dozen or so. They're far less menacing when they're dead. I make a show of studying them as if I'm looking for something very specific. Do you have anything, I don't know, bigger? I hold my hands farther apart for emphasis. The fishmonger holds up his index finger for me to wait while he disappears into a walk-in cooler. The air conditioning is working overtime, and the whole place is alive with an electric hum. The windows are yellowed with cellophane, giving everything a doleful pall. A few flies buzz near the doorway, but they steer clear of the fish. I wonder if they don't like the ice. An elderly Chinese woman looks at oyster sauces. We make eye contact, and I offer a smile. She is nonplussed. The man returns with a larger specimen, one that I think will do nicely. I nod, and he smiles and wraps it up in waxy paper. When he hands it to me, I say, "There's one more thing I need." The fishmonger looks expectantly at me. I nod to what I see behind him. He gestures at some prawns. I shake my head no. "That." He turns around, confused, until he sees what I'm pointing to. I want to buy his cleaver. Now he shakes his head. Not with disgust, but almost. Certainly profound disapproval. This is just like Gremlins. I can hear him say, "You do with Mogwai what your society has done with all of nature's gifts. You do not understand." But instead of Mogwai, I hear octopus. I doubt the octopus is a gift. If it is, it's a gift I'm hell-bent on returning. I point again, insistently, and pull a small wad of 20s from my pocket. He looks at the money. After some hesitation, he pries the cleaver free. When I return from my errand, Lily is sitting in her bed, awake, staring off in the direction of the stove. She doesn't hear me, but the octopus does. The paper package under my arm rustles as I enter the kitchen, and my keys land on the table with a jingling clang. I put the package on the large cutting board by the sink, then pick up the cutting board and the package together, and bring them to the table where the octopus can see. I cast a sideways glance back at Lily to make sure he's watching. He is. I fumble for a moment with the string that ties the package. While I often have difficulty with knots, this fumbling is mostly for dramatic effect. Mostly so I can produce my new cleaver and bring it down with a thud on the string at the flatter end of the package. I can feel it sink into the cutting board. While I don't particularly want to sacrifice my good cutting board, the overall effect is without equal, so I can't help but not care. We're leaving here soon, anyway.
"What's in the package?"
It's the octopus talking. Success. I have piqued his interest. "Oh, you'll see." I carefully undo the bundle and the paper makes an awful rumpling sound. The smell hits me before I even have the last of it folded open. It hits Lily only a nanosecond afterward, and she rouses from her trance, and her sniffer hits the air, and she makes her way over to where I am, stopping only when she bumps into my shins. She plays her part perfectly, a stretch limousine to deliver this party's guest of honor.
"Seriously," the octopus says, "what's in the package?"
"You want to know?" I gnash my teeth into the most evil grin. "This." I unfold the final flap of paper and hoist the dead octopus up by its head. Juices drip from its flaccid arms onto the floor.
Whoa!
The octopus exclaims, and uses one of his arms to shield his eyes.
Is that what I think it is?
Yep.
That's barbaric!
The octopus has no sense of irony.
Yup,
I say again.
Oh, God. The smell. Who is that even?
I don't know its name. I never thought to ask the fishmonger if it ever had one. I look at the dead octopus, limp and gray. It has only a faded purple hue, like a dying violet. The color is the only thing about it, really, that even suggests there once was life in it.
Iris, I answer.
I look down at Lily, who is hungrily lapping up octopus drippings from the floor. I always did like naming things after flowers.
Oh, man. I have an Aunt Iris.
This causes me to cackle wickedly, like one of Shakespeare's witches.
Probably not anymore. When the hurly-burly's done, when the battle is lost and won.
I push the paper aside and slap the dead octopus down onto the cutting board. It lands with a moist and meaty splat. I pry my cleaver loose and bring it down hard on one of the arms, cutting off a good 3 inches. The octopus screams.
Fair is foul and foul is fair. Hover through the fog and the filthy air.
I toss the arm piece to Lily and it lands on the floor with a wet slap. Lily finds it almost instantly and gobbles it up with one bite.
Stop! 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 Are you crazy?
I think about my new mantra.
Not crazy enough.
I pry the cleaver free of the cutting board and bring it down again, trimming a few inches off another arm.
Egad!
The octopus gargles with horror. I toss more of the dead octopus to Lily, who seems to be enjoying this as much as I am.
I'm sorry, is this bothering you?
I ask the octopus, faking concern.
Of course it's bothering me! Oh, God! Can actually taste it through her skull!
The octopus is turning green.
I think I'm gonna throw up!
I shrug.
Be glad it's only your aunt.
Cleaver.
Chop!
Toss a bite to Lily.
What do you mean?
I grab the cleaver and crouch low to look the octopus in the eye. Lily continues to cooperate by licking the floor where the octopus bits have landed. With her head bowed, the octopus and I are face to face. Eye to eye. Mano a mano. I hold the cleaver an inch from his face.
Make no mistake, octopus. You leave tonight. You leave, or I will rent a boat. And I swear to God, I will trawl the oceans with a fucking net until I catch everyone you
love. The octopus looks up at me like I wouldn't
dare. And then, I will come back here, and I will chop them up, and I will feed them to my dog, and you can taste their stinking
flesh. To drive my point home, I stand up and firm my grip around the
cleaver. Womp! Your mother!
I toss a piece of octopus to Lily, and she catches it before it hits the ground.
Womp!
Another piece.
Your father!
This one hits the floor with a splat, and Lily is on it in seconds.
Womp! Your brother!
I don't have a brother!
I snarl.
Womp! Your sister!
Stop it!
You got a wife? I've got all day. How about it, Lily? Do you like this game?
Yes! Chewy! Happiness! More! Salty! Meat! For! Lily! Please!
Okay, okay, okay. You made your point.
You'll leave? I wave the cleaver ominously in front of him.
You said I have until tonight.
The octopus remains sly to the very end. Did I say that? I don't remember what I said. I'll have to find out if blinding rage, murderous rage, is a natural part of grief. Is it normal for me in this stage to want to make my enemies suffer, or have I gone irreparably too far? I lock eyes with the octopus and tug at my shirt sleeve.
What?
He asks. I roll up the sleeve to slowly reveal my tattoo. 8 octopus arms hang from my bicep, and I can feel the octopus's eyes growing bigger. I pull up my shirt even farther, revealing Cal's work from the bottom up in dramatic fashion. Finally, my shirt sleeve is up near my shoulder and my entire tattoo is revealed. A dachshund, standing triumphantly on the head of an octopus. This is goodbye, you son of a bitch. I flex, making sure the octopus drinks it in before striking the cleaver down on the cutting board with such force it shatters the board in two. I am the octopus now.
The Pelagic Zone. The Law for the Wolves. Continued. When pack meets with pack in the jungle, and neither will go from the trail, lie down till the leaders have spoken. It may be fair words shall prevail. When ye fight with a wolf of the pack, ye must fight him alone and afar, lest others take part in the quarrel and the pack be diminished by war. Rudyard Kipling. Fishful Thinking. I have been preparing and packing for days, meticulously checking off items and tasks on a half-dozen carefully constructed lists. Lily is still asleep when I zip the last of our bags closed. They lie stacked in a pile by the bedroom door, dwarfing Lily and maybe even me, waiting to be carried, first to the car, and then onto our waiting ship. The supplies are daunting. There's no telling how long we'll be gone, how dangerous our voyage will be. Trent, despite his suggestion that I need to stop playing the octopus's game, has warned me that I am running from an obvious fate, and I understand his concern for us. This is a dangerous undertaking. I, on the other hand, feel like I'm in control for the very first time since this whole ordeal began. I drink in the sight of my sweet gosling resting peacefully in the feathered nest of our bed's duvet. It's almost enough to make me want to crawl back under the covers with her. It has been 2 days since the octopus left. Without fanfare or goodbyes, he just fled in the night. Disappeared, just as he promised he would when I fed Lily her gruesome meal. Without our unwanted visitor, it feels like we were in the calm eye of a storm. The waters are still, and the winds have subsided, and there's great beauty in the fragile peace, despite the promise of the storm soon to rage again. Asleep like this, whiskered cheeks puffing with each gentle breath, Lily reminds me of her puppy self, the puppy who dreamed of badgers and beaches, of warm laps, and wrestling and sunshine and hunting. I don't know if I've scared the octopus into permanent retreat, or where he has even gone. It almost doesn't matter. Almost. Neither Lily nor I can sit idly by hoping he doesn't return. Perhaps this time with reinforcements. There's only one option that lies ahead for us. I place one hand on Lily's chest, and startled, she jerks awake. Shh, 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 I say. She looks up at me and yawns, her jaw squeaking like a hinge and her legs stretching horizontally for ground that isn't there. It takes her a moment to notice the stack of weathered oilcloth duffel bags, creating a mountainous sculpture in the corner. With the octopus gone, she can once again see.
What in the world?
Lily asks. I remember her climbing into my suitcase as a puppy when I would haul it out of the closet to pack for a trip. A pile of bags such as this one must be confusing. Which one should she jump into? Those are our supplies.
Those are our supplies for what?
She slowly sits upright on the mattress and shakes the sleep out of her head, ears flapping madly like wings.
For our adventure.
I scratch her on top of her head where the octopus used to sit. My touch is gentle in case it's sore. It's good to feel her soft fur there again.
Remember? I told you, we're going on an awfully big adventure.
Lily turns and licks herself in an awkward place before asking,
Yes, but an awfully big adventure where?
I look her square in the eyes. I want to protect her.
at the very least, not to startle her. But there's no benefit in soft pedaling if she is to be my co-captain on this voyage. We're going on an octopus hunt. It's still dark when Lily drags the last duffel bag down the few steps from the house to the curb with her teeth. I load them carefully into the car. Inside are clothes for me, to protect against the elements, including a cabled sweater I wear during Christmases back east, because it makes me look like a fisherman. Blankets for Lily, as well as a life jacket, like Wheezy's. Size just for her. Canned goods and kibble, rawhide shoes, a few books on sailing and the sea, including works by Hemingway, Melville, and several by Patrick O'Brien. Fishing nets and a harpoon, a compass. Jugs of drinking water, matches. A deck of cards. Lily's red ball. 3 bottles of Glenlivet, aged 18 years. And a harmonica, which I don't know how to play. The car, full, we say goodbye to the house. It's hard. I didn't really think about this part in formulating my plan. Neither of us can say for certainty when, or if, we'll see our home again. We drive the 30 miles or so to Long Beach. Despite the early hour, the route is surprisingly populated with cars, but not enough to cause a delay. The drive is mostly silent, except for quiet, wet sounds as Lily continues to lick herself. I wonder if in the course of this whole ordeal I've forgotten to give her her flea medicine. Nothing I can do about it now. On the plus side, there probably aren't many fleas at sea. The sun is just cracking the skyline when we reach the marina, and I pull into the only available spot and stop the car. It sits underneath a sign that says, "No overnight parking," and I can only imagine the stack of tickets that will greet us if we ever return. Through some tough negotiating via telephone over the past 2 days, I've secured us the use of the trawler named Fishful Thinking. She presents herself at the end of the docks, just as the morning fog is lifting, and I get my first real glimpse of her. The boat is not fancy and needs a fresh coat of paint, but she's sturdy, romantic even in her slight weariness, and she has logged time at sea. Fishful Thinking has a forward deckhouse, 2 masts, main and secondary, an aft working deck, and outriggers on either side. Our lease is open-ended.
"Are you Ted?"
The man who owns her is salty and gray. He wears a sweater like the one I've packed, but his is full of holes. Instead of a pipe, he smokes, or vapes, I guess, an e-cigarette, which surprises me, and I find the whole thing distasteful and inauthentic. I don't know why his poor lung health would be essential for a successful launch, but somehow in my head it is. "I am? And this is she?" I ask, tapping my hand on the roof of the deckhouse.
"This be her."
He helps me load our supplies below decks as Lily mostly sits back on the wharf and watches. She shifts her feet when the dock rocks underfoot as we carry the heavy bags. I let her sit and enjoy a quiet moment getting used to her surroundings. She will need to gain 4 sea legs, while I will only need 2.
"Sure aren't packing light,"
the man says, his voice full of gravel and booze.
"No, sir. We aim to be prepared."
"What are you preparing for?"
I think about this. I've never been on an octopus hunt before, and since it's impossible to foresee all the potential dangers ahead, I choose my reply carefully. "For anything."
"There's only one of you, and the little one can't require much."
He nods at Lily. "We may be gone some time." The truth.
"Where are you headed? Can I get that much out of you?"
I throw down a heavy duffel, and it kicks up dust, and we both cough. The man inhales deeply on his cigarette, and his vapor cloud mixes with the dust before the air settles, and I answer, "Out where the octopuses live." The man looks startled and nearly drops the bag he's carrying, but he catches it at the last second and sets it down. I can hear the clink of glass bottles. It must be the bag with the scotch. His face takes on an apprehensive expression, and he stands and twists, cracking the bones in his spine, his old sweater hanging loose and tattered off his frame.
The water's neither close to the bottom nor near to the top, nor within reach of any shore.
The pelagic zone. I've done my reading. That's where our destiny lies. The man nods.
What the Greeks would call the open sea.
I don't give a damn about the Greeks, but I smile anyway. I only care about one thing. Will fishful thinking make it? The man takes another drag on his blue-tipped cigarette and sizes me up and down. He blows vapor into our tight quarters, our shared breathing space.
It's not the boat I'm worried about.
I look past the man just in time to see Lily appear on the steps that lead below the deck to where we are. She sits quietly and listens. I wonder if she's overheard his concern.
You don't need to worry about us, I say. We are adventurers, she and I. This is nothing new. We may not look like much, but we are stout of heart, and we have a mission.
The open seas don't frighten us. At least not as much as doing nothing, sitting home and waiting for the octopus, or worse, to return. I suppose we had a deal, a truce of sorts, but I'm confident he won't keep his end of the bargain. So, why should I keep mine?
The sea is full of things not seen, things that don't care how stout you been.
There's menace in the rhyme. It's exactly one of those things we are seeking. And oh, what I'll do to him when I find him. The boat rocks gently in the harbor. Not far away, angry gulls are fighting over a scrap of food.
Shoot yourself, the man says.
He can see that there's no changing our minds. We'll have her back safe, I say, rapping the walls of the boat with my knuckles. Made of solid bones, she echoes a sturdy reply. The man takes another puff of vapor.
Either way, I have your deposit, he says,
and cackles a smoker's laugh, full of phlegm and wheeze. He turns and heads for the deck before stopping.
How many tickles does it take to make an octopus laugh?
Is he serious? In my experience, octopuses are foul creatures, incapable of the lightness of laughter. Not knowing what else to say, I answer, does it matter?
10 tickles!
The man guffaws until he almost chokes. He bends forward almost in half and braces himself on the rail. I tense up, worried I may have to perform CPR. I don't want to put my mouth anywhere near that old goat. Finally, he gets himself under control and waves us off.
That's an old joke.
On his way up the stairs, he pats Lily on the head and repeats himself to her.
An old joke, that one.
The whole time Lily doesn't break wary eye contact with me. When the man is gone, I do my best to deflect her concern. Don't worry, I tell her. I remembered to pack Red Ball. She looks at me like I'd better have. The Old Lady and the Sea. No matter which direction you look from our perch inside the deckhouse, there's nothing to see but sea. There's blue, and there's gray, and there's green, plus every combination those colors can make. And it's hard to spot the horizon. I can no longer tell what is water and what is the great expanse of cloudy sky. We're 17 days into our journey, and I wonder if we're still alive. The pelagic zone is unyielding. Lily and I were game at first, keen for the adventure that lay ahead. But around day 8, we succumbed to the lethargic nature of life at sea, to the monotony of it all. The deckhouse was closing in on us, and could, in the extended days, roast as hot as an oven. The air fouled by our own perspiration and cooking flesh. The one thing I forgot to pack was sunscreen, and we burned for days until we tanned. Everything on the boat seemed coated with grime and salt. We took turns with the chores, scrubbing the deck, cleaning up after meals, steering, keeping watch for the octopus. I did most of the food preparation, mostly because Lily has no ability to stop herself from eating whatever ration she can get her paws on before it's even cooked. At night, we traded the watch, sleeping in shifts so we always had 2 eyes on the water. That lasted 3 nights before exhaustion settled in, and we curled up together. She in the nook behind my knees, the way we would always sleep at home. It was comforting for us both. I kept a logbook of our progress, detailed accounts of the days and how the time ticked by. At least I did on the outset of the journey. The last entry reads simply, daylight, head west by south, distance 65 nautical miles, winds light. On day 6 we saw lightning, and the swell rose with an advancing storm. We rode out the worst of it below decks, playing crazy eights, but the game reminded me too much of the octopus, and I quickly soured on it. I let Lily win 2 hands, and while shuffling the discard pile a second time, I suggested we play war. On day 9, I took to carving some driftwood we picked out of the sea. I'd read in one of the books on sailing that whalers used to carve ivory and bone, and sometimes coconuts and tortoise shells, in an art they called scrimshaw. My knife would never have carved ivory or bone, and I don't know if I'd call what I did art, but I managed a pretty good likeness of a dachshund out of the driftwood. I told Lily it was her mother, Witchy-Poo, who would look out for us and keep us safe.
"My mother's name is Witchy-Poo?" she asked.
"Yes," I replied. "You know that." Before 2 weeks were even out, I was unrecognizable as my former self. I was desperate for a shower. My beard had grown out rough and scraggly, filled with salt, both in color and from the ocean air. My skin had burned and peeled and leathered. I caught a glimpse of my reflection in the deckhouse window and thought I was someone else. I don't think Lily would have recognized me either were she not here to witness my slow mutation.
"Your coat is mahogany," Lily told me. "Like mine."
We both now have gray hairs under our chins. On day 15, I swallowed my fear and jumped off the bow into the ocean. The water was shocking, then invigorating. I thought of the monsters below, of the octopus attaching itself to my leg and pulling me down to great depths, of my head exploding from the density of water, of drowning, but only for the briefest of moments. I felt too alive to die. It took a great deal of encouraging, but at sunset, I talked Lily into a swim. I held her tight with 2 hands and close to my body, using my legs to kick and keep us afloat. And she paddled with her paws, but mostly out of panic. "I've got you, monkey, and I'm never letting go." Together we drifted, looking at the orange sky, clouds tinged with lava from an unseen volcano. I put my head back in the water, submerging my ears, and for the first time in days, everything fell quiet. I kept one eye on fishful thinking so we wouldn't drift too far, but I let all of our other cares wash away. It felt like a baptism of sorts. Once we had been submerged in the ocean, we were protected by it. We were now pure. It's now day 17. We've stopped putting tuna fish on bread or a plate and just eat it out of the can. It's easier that way, and there's less to clean up. I glance at Lily, who finishes her can first. She gazes stoically ahead. The light accentuates the gray on her neck and around her whiskers, and a little bit between her eyes. She is no longer young. She is no longer my girl.
"I think it's funny you packed canned tuna for an adventure at sea," she says, with only a modicum of judgment.
I look around at the nets and the trawlers and all the gear that decorates fishful thinking. "Funny ha-ha or funny strange?" She doesn't answer. I finish my meal and I gather the empty tins. We'll run out of canned tuna eventually and have to fish for our meals from the sea. But I don't tell her this. There's no need to play on her fears.
"How will we know when we find the octopus?"
she asks again, studying the ever-changing ripples surrounding the hull. I have only the answer I have given her each time she has asked this question before. I scratch her under the chin, and the tags on her collar shake. "We'll know." For the past 2.5 weeks, despite the boredom, despite the monotony, I have thought of little else but the octopus. He will not allow us this deep into his waters and resist the urge to announce himself. He'll take our presence in his home as a personal affront, much the way I resented his presence in ours. At night, when I have trouble sleeping, I steel myself for a great battle at sea. I picture this monster wrapping his muscular arms around our vessel, trying to pierce the hull with his beak, while Lily and I try desperately to outmaneuver, fight back, and harpoon. It's nothing I haven't dreamed of doing to him in other ways, with surgery and radiation and pills. It's 2-1, this fight, but I'm still not sure we're evenly matched. He has the advantage of the sea.
"And why are we hunting him again?"
Lily asks. I check the ship's compass and correct our course 5 degrees southwest. "It's the best chance we have of staying together." Lily stands, turns around 3 times, then sits again. She does this when she's bored. "Do you want to sing a song?" I ask.
"Not really,"
she replies. "I could try my hand at the harmonica again." Lily cringes, but remains polite.
"No, thank you."
"We'll find him," I assure her. "It's just that the ocean is so vast."
"So is Los Angeles."
To a dachshund, that probably seems equivalent.
"Not this vast."
I study our charts. If I'm reading them correctly, we're over a particularly deep trench. Something in me tells me the octopus is near. Lily looks over the side of the boat and says,
"It's a wonder he ever left all this to come and live with us."
I'd never given much thought to the octopus's motivations. The why of it all seemed irrelevant. But Lily's right. It is a wonder. I hope the octopus has the same thought about us right before we harpoon him through his fleshy head. Lily blanches in a way that makes me question for the first time whether she's come to feel some sympathy for that parasite. Stockholm syndrome. Capture bonding, whatever they call it. I hope she doesn't. I don't want that to be true. I don't want her to hesitate when it comes time for the kill. The sun fades. We've made a habit of watching it sink below the horizon, and tonight is no different. We sit out on Fishful Thinking's bow, me Indian style, and her perched in the gap in my legs. And as the sun dips out of sight, I say, "Going, going, going, gone." And then usually we make some kind of wish. It's my favorite moment of the day. "What's the first thing you want to do when we get back home?" Lily considers this.
"I'm not sure I've thought about it."
Does she know something I don't? Or is this just part of her canine ability to live entirely in the present? Part of me doesn't want to know. "Well, I don't know about you, but I want to take a hot shower and sleep a good long sleep in our own bed. And have a slice of Village Pizzeria pizza with roasted red peppers and black olives. And a cold Sam Adams beer." The idea of it, of going home, piques Lily's interest. Even if she's not confident of it happening. Even if it's only a game.
"I'd like to have peanut butter in my Kong. I want to sniff around the backyard and fall asleep in your lap when it's still."
The rocking of the boat has been getting the better of both of us. "Good choices," I say enthusiastically. A cool breeze sweeps across the deck of the boat, causing an eerie, almost haunted whistle.
"And I'd like a large bowl of chicken and rice, even though I'm not sick."
"Seasick, maybe," I say.
"Sick of the sea,"
she replies. I nod. She means the chicken and rice I always make for her when her stomach is upset. I don't know why I don't make the effort more often, since she clearly loves it. I can't really make it for her here. We don't have any chicken. Suddenly, the stars appear, brilliant and sparkling in all their majestic glory. "Can I tell you something else?"
"Always,"
she says. Immediately I say, "Never mind."
"No. What?"
I should never have said anything. I think about how what I was going to say would sound to Lily. About how it suggests a future without her. The very least a future where it is no longer just the two of us. but I've opened my stupid mouth, and I can't think of a plausible lie, so I feel compelled to finish my thought. I'd like to fall in love again. In the silence that follows, all you can hear is the rhythmic hum of Fishful Thinking's engine. We're so far from the shore, there's not even the caw of a passing gull. I know this makes Lily jealous, the idea of my falling in love. She doesn't like to share my affection with anyone. I never explicitly told her that dogs don't live as long as people. I wonder, from her time with the octopus, how much she knows. I wonder if in the last few weeks she's contemplated mortality, like I have.
You will,
she says. Then, almost as an afterthought,
I promise.
A shooting star zips through the sky, and I point and yell, look! But Lily doesn't turn fast enough to see it. Scarlight, scar bright, first scar I see tonight. The light of a full moon streams through the opening at the top of the stairs, casting a bluish pall below decks. Maybe pall is too strong a word. Maybe it's the scotch and not the moon coloring my mood. Even so, I pour myself another two fingers. I should ration it more carefully, but right now it's a smoky salve I crave. I undress Lily for bed, which means unsnapping the life jacket I've insisted she wear at all times, since I first sensed the octopus nearby. She looks up at me as I do this, with an inquisitive expression. What? I ask her.
There's a patch just under your chin where your beard doesn't grow.
I feel under my chin. The coarse hairs are getting almost unruly, and I separate them with my fingers, finding just the spot Lily mentions. I can feel smooth skin. Oh, that. That's a scar. Lily is only momentarily satisfied with my answer.
What's a scar?
It's the spot that's left behind after the healing of a cut or a burn or a wound. Lily considers this.
How did you get it?
When I was 5, I pushed my sister Meredith into the coffee table, and she split open her chin. It was mean and careless and a dumb thing for me to do. I don't even remember why I did it, except I used to do a lot of things to Meredith because she was close to me in age and often simply there. One time I shoved a pink crayon up her nose and snapped it off. A doctor had to remove it with tiny forceps. Another time I convinced her to rub an entire jar of Vaseline through her hair. She had to have a drastic haircut after that.
None of that explains really how you got the scar on your chin.
I think about the point I am trying to make. The best answer I can give you is that karma can be a bitch.
What's karma?
Lily wants to know. Karma is the belief that a person's actions in the present decide their fate in the future. A week after I pushed Meredith into the coffee table, I fell in the bathtub and split my own chin open, and that's how I got this scar. Lily mulls this over before saying,
I have a sister named Meredith.
No, I correct. I have a sister named Meredith. You have sisters named Kelly and Rita.
And my mother's name is Witchy Poo.
That's right. I take the Witchy Poo talisman out of my pocket and place it over the bed. Lily hops up on the mattress and sniffs it.
I have a scar,
Lily says, turning around on the bed so that I can see the length of her back. She looks back at me with doleful eyes. Yes, you do, from surgery when you ruptured two discs in your back. You gave me quite a scare. I often wonder how much she remembers the experience, or if she's blocked most of it from her mind. I guess if she's aware of the scar on her back, the events have left her scarred in other less obvious places. I take off my pants, fold them, and put them aside. I've been wearing the same underwear for 3 days without taking the time to wash them. See these here? I place my bare leg up on the bunk. These scars in my leg are from my own surgery when a doctor opened my leg to pull out several veins. Lily makes a sour face.
Why did he do that?
Their valves had collapsed, and they had no way to return blood to my heart. The doctor yanked them out like a bird pulling worms from the ground. Lily blinks and lowers her head.
What about this mark over my eye?
I grab her snout and lower her head even more.
That? That's nothing. A pleasure scar.
You were chasing your red ball so diligently, you ran headfirst into the stove.
Lily laughs as if even she thinks that's a dumb thing for her to have done.
And then, as if by instinct, she scurries across the room and finds her red ball under the little table where we sometimes eat when we tire of looking at the sea.
She hops up onto our bunk and drops the ball safely at her feet.
I hold out the index finger on my left hand as scotch laps against the sides of my glass, like the ocean against our hull. There's a mark just above the knuckle that joins the finger to the hand.
This here I got battling you.
Battling me?
That's right. I was putting groceries away and you snatched a chorizo sausage right out of my hands, chomping down on my finger in the process.
I did?
You wanted that sausage so badly you wouldn't let up on my finger.
What did you do?
I punched you in the snot locker and laid you among the bok choy, just so I could have my finger back.
Lily shrugs.
I'm a sausage dog.
I know you are. Lily twists again.
What about this thing poking out the side of me here?
I press on the side of her abdomen and feel her floating rib.
Oh, that. When you were a puppy, you fell down a flight of stairs. The doctor thinks you broke a rib.
I didn't know it at the time, but it must have healed funny. You scared me a lot when you were a puppy. I raise my glass and toast.
I'll drink to your floating rib.
Lily hops off the bed and over to her water dish on the floor.
And I'll drink to yours.
She laps thirstily at the water. I don't bother explaining that I don't have a floating rib. I get where she's coming from. Lily jumps back onto the bunk and asks,
Do you have any more scars?
Just on my heart, but only the figurative kind. Lily looks like she's trying to figure that one out. Over the years, I've tried to explain about Jeffrey, about how he was there for 6 years, and then suddenly he was not. How the yelling and the sadness and the quiet and the deceit were not how love was supposed to be. Even now, I'm not sure she entirely understands. I sit down next to her on the bed and scratch behind her ears.
Did the octopus come to me because of karma?
She asks. I'm taken aback by the question. And when I finally understand what she is asking, the whole thing is like a meaty punch to the gut.
No. No, of course not.
But you said a person's actions in the present...
I cut her off. That's just it. A person's. Dogs, on the other hand. Dogs have pure souls. Look at me. I grab her chin and look straight into her eyes. Dogs are always good and full of selfless love. They are undiluted vessels of joy who never, ever deserve anything bad that happens to them. Especially you. Since the day I met you, you have done nothing but make my life better in every possible way. Do you understand? Lily nods.
So, no. The octopus did not find you because of karma.
She nods again, and I let go of her chin. I throw back the last of the scotch and set the empty glass down on the floor with a clunk.
Shall we?
I climb into the bunk with her. Something is catching me not right under my back, and I reach under the blanket and produce red ball. I set it on the floor next to the empty glass. I tap on the witchy poo charm for luck. And I blow out the candle in our lantern. Lily gives me a gentle kiss on my nose, and I kiss her back in the groove between her eyes. I don't tell her what I've wondered myself in the darker moments since our ordeal began. If the octopus, in fact, did come to her because of karma. But not karma for her actions. Karma, perhaps, for mine.
Midnight.
I'm straddling Lily, punching her repeatedly in the snout and yelling, Die! 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 Tears are falling from my face and my knuckles are searing with pain and the air is fire. and my lungs and my heart and my everything burns. I don't remember anything but betrayal. The sharp realization that Lily is the octopus, that she has been deceiving me all along. I no longer know anything. I don't know where the boat ends or the water begins, where the water ends or where the sky begins, where the sky ends or near space begins, where near space ends or where the darkness begins, or where the darkness ends. I don't know if the boat has capsized. I don't know if the bed has crashed to the ceiling, if the windows will burst and water will rush in and we will drown. I don't know if the whole world is upside down or just mine. I don't know anything except the pain of betrayal as I pummel my sweet dog in the face. And that's when I wake up, gasping for air. I turn immediately to Lily, who is sound asleep. Her face is perfect, unmolested by violence. She is not the octopus. She could never betray me. It's not possible. It's not in her to do so. And yet the dream was so real, as if it were foreshadowing gloom. She looks so beautiful, so calm. I force myself to shake the feeling, but not before whispering, "Please don't ever die." Which is an impossible request of any living thing. There's a wetness by my side, and I'm immediately afraid that the octopus is back. But the culprit this time is me. Or more accurately, the now empty scotch bottle I find by my side. I reach to wipe my eyes awake, but miss and hit my nose. That's when I realize I'm drunk. Wash daily from nose tip to tail tip. Drink deeply, but never too deep. And remember the night is for hunting. And forget not the day is for sleep. I don't know the rhyme or why that's in my head, or who said it, or where it's from. Kipling? It doesn't matter. I just have the overwhelming feeling I'm breaking rules, laws, edicts, things meant to be followed, things not meant to be broken, forces not meant to be tested. Complete darkness falls over our quarters as the moon passes behind a cloud. As are we. Behind a cloud. We've lost sight of the journey, our purpose in being here. We are hunters, and the night is for hunting, and here we are, drunk and asleep. If the octopus were to strike now, we would be easy prey, pathetic, ripe for the killing. How did this happen? How did I allow it to be? I look at my sleeping love and silently beg her forgiveness. What have I gotten us into? She doesn't need this. She doesn't want this. She doesn't understand revenge. And while I prefer to think of our voyage as an offensive maneuver, there's no denying that's partly what this is. Revenge. You weighed anchor in our waters, now we sail deeply in yours. I stumble out of bed in the way drunk people do, clumsily and with great kerfuffle. I stand up too tall and bang my head on the ceiling. I trip over the empty scotch bottle, and it sends red balls scooting across the floor with a clang. Quickly, I pick up the bottle to silence it. I look at Lily. If anything will wake her, it's the sound of red ball roaring alive to play and bouncing against the clabberd. Yet, she sleeps soundly through it, a sign of our thorough depletion. I climb the few steps up to the deck and let the night breeze wash over me. I inhale it deeply. The stars I can see number in the thousands. Thousands more hang behind the clouds. The boat sways and I nearly lose my balance, so I lie flat on the deck and look up. I am so very small. Physically small, but also petty. Why am I driven more by revenge than by forgiveness? I think about all the people I need to forgive. Jeffrey? We loved each other. And yet love alone was not enough. Did he throw it all away with his indiscretions? Or was I never available enough in the relationship to keep his eye from wandering? In the end, we were probably equally neglectful of what we had. So why was there so much anger when it was time to walk away? My mother for not saying she loves me? We're too often guilty of thinking that our parents arrived on this planet as fully functioning adults on the day that we were born. That they don't have pasts of their own prior to our birth. That the father,